It's on.
So, would you like to fill in the bit about your father first? I mean, you said in your notes, literally, something which I really must get right, I think. Something about the nature, her dependence on him or something, and I said that she became dependent, and you said, I don't think she came to lean heavily on my father. I think she always did. Mm. See, I hadn't realised that, actually. I hadn't captured the quality of the relationship between them. In what way was she dependent on him, do you think?
Well, I think she always talked with him about everything she was doing. Wrote to him at great length when she was away from him about what was happening. The few letters that I have still got give details of what was happening at various meetings that she'd been to and things like that. And certainly when I was there to see what was going on, she was always discussing everything she was involved with.
Really?
With him. And getting support from him, even if he didn't really approve of the society or of her involvement in it, which she often didn't.
What sort of support would it be? Just somebody to talk to in a general way, or would she actually say, now what do you think I should do in this situation?
Yes, both.
Really?
Both. Mm. Really? She wouldn't necessarily do what he said he thought she should do, but yes, she did ask.
So really it was, in a sense, a sort of partnership, an intellectual partnership, mm. in relation to her interests. See, I hadn't realised that.
Yeah. And I think that really that was why that she fell in love with him, because he was the first person she'd known to whom she could talk about everything that interested her.
Really?
And who not only listened in intelligently and contributed things, but had other ideas that she hadn't had to throw into the discussion.
You mean that there was nobody in her personal, her mother's, her parents' family, who could take that sort of role?
Not after her grandfather died. Yes. That was the Chartist.
You're right, yes.
And I think he died when she was very young, so probably it was much more her listening to him than her talking to him.
Yes, yes.
But
yes.
Certainly she had no intellectual support or contact really with her own family. They just weren't on the same wavelength. And they must have been friends. I mean, there was Jimmy Mallon at the Manchester University settlement, and a man called McClellan who ran the William Morris Press. But certainly Father was the first man towards whom she'd felt emotionally involved, with whom she had this kind of intellectual rapport too.
Yes. And yet, well, this fits in with another thing you say. It was important for them to agree, was it?
Yes, yes.
Why, really?
Well, do you mean generally or in relation to her work?
Well, both, really.
Generally, because their marriage was to be a complete partnership, and in essence it was. But obviously if they disagreed completely about something where action was required or attitudes had to be taken, this was very painful to them, because neither of them could accept that one should dominate the other.
Right, right,
I see. It wasn't the sort of marriage where people divide things and say, all right, you can have your way about this and I'll have mine about that. They had to agree about everything.
And that goes for politics. It's not just for
family.
Well,
I don't know. I think that Mother wanted this in politics, and not perhaps entertainment and artistic pleasures, but certainly politics and morals and ethics. I think Father would have been prepared, well, he was, more easily to differ and leave it at that, but she wanted it to be a complete partnership.
Mm. That's very interesting. Very interesting. See, I hadn't really realised that. So, the point, I think the context of actually that, where that arose was about your father having a capacity for sulking for
long
periods.
That's right, yes.
It was he who sulked then, was it? I mean, if she wants it so much, why doesn't she sulk?
Well, she didn't. She thought that you could always reason everybody round in the end, so she just went on arguing.
Yes, I see. So the only defence against this is, in fact, not to talk.
Yes.
Really, from the man's point of view. Yes, I see. Yes.
And I think he did develop it at first as a child, because he had four sisters, and he was in the middle, and I think he just went away from them when he could, and if he couldn't go away physically, he just shut up, took himself away mentally.
So they both have this capacity to shut off, because you remember your mother says at one point, I think I quoted her, how I can still cut off or something. I can't quite remember.
Yes, it little surprised me because
it
wasn't my experience of her.
Really? Yes. I can't quite remember the quotation. It was, I can't remember the context now. It was, she was talking about something in child. Oh, it was in relation to her mother, I think. It wasn't it? It was fairly early on. See, I wrote this some time ago now. But I thought it was rather odd. I meant to ask you, actually, here we are. A single word can start me. An odd look, a silence, anything, even a year-long smile, can imprison me, so there's no possibility of speech.
Yes, but that wasn't my experience of her.
Yes.
The only thing that relates to that is she couldn't ask for help. You know, just about ordinary domestic things. If you didn't notice that she was getting into trouble with something, or that she was tired out, and offer help, she couldn't ask for it, and then she was furious that you hadn't offered it. You know?
That's frightfully difficult, yes.
And Father and I tended to be totally absorbed in whatever we were reading, and the house could have started to fall down before we'd have noticed. You know?
What, supposing I had a paragraph on your father, I think I probably do need to have a paragraph, you know, sort of describing what he was like. I mean, I've got a few ideas, but not nearly enough. And what sort of things would you like to see in there? What that would really bring the essence of your father to life, really? What would you fix on? A difficult question, isn't it?
Yes. In my childhood, he was the excitement and the laughter and the lightening. Also, when I was very young, he was rather intimidating, though I don't know why. But I would say, you know, if he was going to be cross with me, that was really something terrible. He never hit me, he never punished me. I mean, I suspect I was banished to my bedroom sometimes, but that's about all. But he was very good with children, especially once they could talk and reason. He could tell marvellous stories. He could invent games. And he loved reading aloud. For the younger ones, he could wiggle his ears and make his tongue come in and out at the same time. he really enjoyed children. And there was lots of laughter and excitement when he was around. You never quite knew what was going to happen next, but it was going to be exciting, you know. Whereas mother, loving care is the first thing that comes into my mind for mother, and warmth. But she was a little serious. Life was solemn. She was a very good listener to me. But, you know, life is a bit dull when father wasn't there.
Yes, yes. What about discipline, actually? Do they differ in their attitude to discipline with you at all?
I don't think so, no.
Both fairly strict, or were they by present-day standards, of course?
Well, not in the sense of punishment, but certainly in the sense that there were some things I wouldn't have dreamed of doing, would never have played truant from school or anything like that.
They got the right values sort of inculcated.
Yes. But I argued with them both because I was brought up to not to take anything on trust, you know, to test everything against your own knowledge, and if your own knowledge wasn't adequate, just to keep it in reserve, as possibly that's true, but I don't know yet, you know. And so, like most parents who take that sort of line, they were a bit startled when I disputed their statements.
I was going to ask you, what happens with each of them, actually, when you do start arguing?
Oh, my mother was always very willing to have an argument, but expected to convince me that she was right. And like father, I didn't sulk for days, but there came a point when I was still quite convinced I was right, but I wasn't going to listen to any more discussion about it, so I had either storm out of the room or burst into tears or whatever was convenient to escape any further argument.
But this she wanted you to agree as well. I mean, that she didn't like, she didn't like this agreement.
No, she didn't.
But is that the same thing as to say that she was domineering, would you say? It's rather crude, really, isn't it?
Yes. No, not really, because she didn't want to have her way because it was her way, because it was what she wanted. She wanted everybody to agree that this great light she had seen was the truth.
Yes, right.
And once they saw it, of course, they would naturally do whatever.
Right.
And once everybody was adequately educated, they too would naturally see the light.
Yes. Where does this come from, do you think? I mean,
I think it comes from not having been adequately educated and having had the capacity to be. I think she should have been able to go to a grammar school and then on to a university, as she probably would have done if she'd been alive when I was alive.
Mm.
And the same applies to him. He did win a scholarship to Marshall College, which is the school of Aberdeen Grammar School, and his father refused to fill up the form which gave details about his income. He wasn't going to tell those people at the council what he earned and so on. And my father was a year below the top age for sitting the scholarship, so he sat it again the following year, by which time the dominie had persuaded my grandfather to sign the form, but they'd moved without the parish. So he never got to Marshall College. And had he got there, I think he would have gone on to university.
Oh, surely he would, yes.
And I think both of them lacked that aspect of education. They both their education stopped, 12-ish. Well, mother's was a bit longer, but it was very ladylike convent education. And thereafter they educated themselves, which is fine as far as it goes, but it doesn't go far enough, does it? It doesn't give you the capacity to discipline your own thought, really, does it? I mean, something interests you, and you read everything you can find about that.
Yes.
But you don't take on board the things which don't interest you, but which it's perhaps a good thing you should learn something about.
Yes, quite. You see, I don't know enough about Roman Catholicism, but I just wonder quite how it gears in with that. I suppose a simple answer would be that she had, quote, seen through one religion, and she wasn't going to, position here, she wasn't going to have any more, so you question and reason, and there's no mysticism or anything. I mean, there's that possibility, but I don't know quite whether she felt that strongly about whether it is related in that rather direct way to her repudiation of Catholicism, her rationality. course, the rationality came first anyway. I mean, in a sense, the rationality undermines Catholicism, so the undermining of Catholicism can't be the cause of this this sort of frame of mind, can it? I mean, it's a furious honesty, in a way. It's a burning honesty, which is, it must have been extremely uncomfortable to live with, actually, sometimes. Certainly to be with, I would have thought.
Well, I think the rejection of Catholicism is also involved with the emotion, with what it did to her mother. I don't think she saw what it did to her father, because she continued to dislike her father all her life, whereas I feel quite sorry for him. Because he was an ordinary and unexceptional, jolly, robust sort of man, and if he'd married a lusty, down-to-earth woman, he'd have been no worse than anybody else. In fact, he'd have always been the life and soul of the party, and he wouldn't have been a bad father by those days' standards. But he married this extremely refined lady who had, who was quite determined not to forget her aristocratic lineage, and who hadn't wanted to get married anyway, wanted to be a nun. And hated sex, and was very poorly equipped for a large family. She had 8 pregnancies and 4 miscarriages. And ultimately denied him any further sex, which was laid upon her then by the priests as her sin. Any crimes, any sins he thereafter committed were her fault.
Really, yes.
And it was this background, I think, probably, maybe the first, more than the rationality, that turned mother against Catholicism. But being mother, of course, she didn't just revolt quietly. She took her doubts to the priest. She spent 5 years discussing her doubts with the priest. That
really,
must have been an ordeal.
Really, I hadn't realised that.
From 12.
Clear. Really, I hadn't realised that. That's not clear from her memoirs at all.
No. I think it must have been very painful.
Yes, painful for everybody. Yes, but getting back to your father then, what's his reaction to this marital college setback, for instance? I mean, is there a permanent sort of grievance then about this?
I think there was a permanent feeling of bitterness against his father, but he had other reasons to be bitter against him. And yet, you see, my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, decided he'd had enough work when he was about 50. So he just stopped and let my father keep him till he died at 94.
Good Lord.
So whatever bitterness father felt, you know, it wasn't that bad. I mean, not many sons would keep their fathers all that length of time, would they?
Right. But did your mother... She was attracted by your father's intelligence then. I mean, when they had an argument, it wouldn't all be one side at all.
No.
I mean, they're fairly evenly matched. Yes. So then a discussion with him is a sort of launching pad, is it, for her?
She sort of tests things out.
See, I hadn't really got that sort of side of it at all. As far as domestic, sort of domestic side of things concerned, it's presumably a fairly conventional marriage as at that time, in the sense that your father presumably didn't do much housework or anything like that. Men didn't, did they?
Well, he did some things which startled the neighbours. He pushed me out in the pram, which wasn't a proper thing to do, and. He tended to get the meals on Sunday.
Really?
And also, in the summer, they lounged about in their pyjamas and dressing gowns all Sunday, which also upset the neighbours very much. continued to share things like washing up, but he would never wash up the pans.
Really?
I used to say, "Hey, you've forgotten the pans," and he would say, "Oh, have I?" And go on drying his hands and walk away.
He also had a very good sense of humour.
Oh, yes.
I mean, which obviously makes up for your mother a bit, doesn't it?
And he bathed me and put me to bed and things like that. I don't suppose he changed nappies, but I can remember being bathed. Great excitement. After the washing was over, he always held my ankles and swished me down the bath so that my head went under the water, but his hand was there to lift it up again. So it was half joy and half terror, you know. And Mother used to appear at the doorway and say, "Fred, how do you expect that child to sleep when you're getting her so excited?"
How was your mother actually regarded by the neighbours? I mean, if you could generalise, was she regarded as a rather strange bird, really?
Oh, I think so, by some of them. We lived in rather an isolated spot in Glasgow, up on a hill, with just country in front, and off that way past a farm. There were about six houses next to us, two rather imposing, well-off houses, and then a row of terrace houses, not unlike those, but red brick. And we only knew two of the neighbours, so I think probably the others didn't feel we were the sort of people who should be known.
Because your mother's political view?
Yes, yes. Mm. And unconventional behaviour.
What, just not dressing on Sundays?
Well, not dressing on Sundays, sitting about outside in the garden in dressing gowns, planting trees on Sundays, things like that. And,
and
of course,
really
lots of women visitors, lots of suffragettes and such coming to the house.
It was Sabbatarian in that part of Scotland still, was it?
Yes, even I, when I went for a walk on Sunday, had to wear gloves.
Really?
And a hat, of course. But then everybody wore hats then.
So supposing neighbours sort of... I suppose your mother came to know about these views and the neighbours, all these disapprovals. Her attitude, I suppose, would be contemptuous, would it? I mean, this is a sort of irrationality that...
Yes, but not passionate contemptuousness. You know, just sort of, that's the way they are, and now I don't bother with them.
Yes. What about your father's career? I mean, your father had a strange sort of career, didn't he? It sort of interrupted in the middle, and he took on that job for the Rotary Club, didn't he? It was about 1938 or something.
Yes, that he became a Rotarian shortly after he came down here as manager, joint managing director of B&W's, and he edited their magazine as an honorary job, and when he had been thrown out of B&W's and his printing business did so badly in Carnaby Street, some of the Rotarians who were very fond of him decided that they could make this a paid job combined with having a paid secretary. They'd only had a voluntary secretary and a clerk before, and they would have a paid secretary, and he would also edit the magazine for them. So they really made the job for him.
And they liked him for the sort of qualities you liked him. He's good fun, good company.
Very good at pricking bubbles and making people laugh at things they didn't normally laugh at. Very good editor. He did quite a bit of writing himself. He had a lot of short stories published in Scotland. And he wrote a play which was produced for many years. It had a one professional run in Glasgow, and thereafter it was very popular on with amateur dramatic societies for a long time.
What was it called?
It was called The Creditors.
Really?
It was written in the Doric. You know, it was very Scottish. And he wrote a bit for Punch, for the Aberdeen paper, Bon Accord. He had a regular column with them for a time. And he wrote two books about billiards, two humorous books about billiards. Really, I wonder if I've got a second copy of that, because I'll send it to you. Because Mother appears in it as Minerva.
Really?
Yes. She makes her... He makes her say rational but inapplicable things about billiards, and then they have a funny discussion about them.
I'd love to have that. If you qualify, I'll look it up. That's called
Billiards in Mufti.
Really?
So he was a good editor, and they liked him. He made the paper quite lively.
What about
his career? I don't quite know how he got into Burroughs and Watts, because he was an insurance agent first of all, after he stopped being an errand boy.
That's a good way up in society, of course, at that time, isn't it? Being an insurance agent, it's like being a pupil teacher, like your mother again. They're both on the way up, in fact, aren't they? Yes.
And then during the war, he did this control of fuel, wasn't it, for the Glasgow area. And just about the time that he was offered the job as joint managing director of B&W's, which involved the move down here, he was also offered a job as curator of one of the Glasgow museums by his brother-in-law, who was the provost. Now, that was a sheer bit of nepotism, because he had absolutely no qualifications to be a curator. And he would obviously have done lots of things he shouldn't, not done lots of things he should, but he would have equipped himself as well as he could, and he would certainly have made museums places children wanted to come to, which they weren't in those days. And he'd have enjoyed it. But I had had bronchitis every winter since I was born, and the doctor had said to Mother that I must be got out of that climate. Glasgow is supposed to have the highest incidence of bronchitis than anywhere in the country. And so he came down to London. Now, this is a bit about Mother and not Father, because she used to tell the story, which I don't believe for a moment was true, that while he was considering these two jobs, she had said that if he didn't take the London one, which would get me out of that climate, she would leave him and take me with her. I'm sure he didn't say it. I'm sure she had no need to say it. And that, I think I wrote a note about dramatisation, which made me feel...
abolished all my relatives.
That's right. Well, that is another thing. I mean, under no circumstances would you have had to threaten Father like that. I'm quite sure my welfare would have been one of the predominant factors in his decision.
What is this? Is this then, why does she do this? To make a tale, to make a dramatic moment, or to entertain? Why does she exaggerate like that?
I can't really work it out.
Because it's, in a sense, it's sort of the reverse of her rationality.
It's a sort of, it's as if she had a score to settle, isn't it? Well, she certainly had a score to settle with her relatives. Mm. Perhaps she felt she had with Father, but she couldn't admit it to herself. But I don't know what. Would you switch off?
I'll always switch it off whenever you want it off. About your father's career, you see, I mean, did he get bitter about the way it had gone wrong in the stationer shop, and why did it go wrong in the stationer shop, do you think? Was he not good in business? Must have been.
Well, yes, he was. He was good. He was very successful in B&W's, but... he wouldn't allow the children of the original founder, long dead, the grandchildren, to step up into jobs he didn't consider they were fit for. And there were enough shares in the family eventually for them to get somebody else to join them in voting him off the board.
I see.
But he had been very successful up to that point. I think the stationer's shop was just unfortunate. Because what happened to it was that Gallagher's started a branch just around the corner and undercut it.
Yes, I see.
Until it was gone.
So did that make him bitter? Resentful? Did he turn in on himself, or did he somehow survive?
No, he did survive. And what would have happened if the Rotary Club hadn't come to the rescue? I don't know. But no, I don't think it made him bitter. I don't think he was ever really bitter.
Mm.
Unhappy at the time, of course, and worried.
Yes.
But
yes.
Not bitter.
Another thing I hadn't realised, I should have realised actually, I didn't realise your mother died of cancer, in fact, which is what she said. She knew about that, did she, in advance?
Yes, I think she'd had suspicion for some time because this diverticulitis she'd had for many, many years, and it kept coming back and getting worse and then going away and then coming back. But she certainly knew for the last 18 months and had had great suspicion for 6 months before that. And she had in fact cancer in three places. She had cancer in the liver, the stomach and the bowels, so it wasn't a very happy end.
So a lot of that urgency, you see, I hadn't realised, a lot of that urgency to write was after she knew she'd got cancer, was it? I hadn't realised.
Well, I think it started as soon as she had recovered initially from father's death. You know, as I say, she became an old woman in a week. And then there was that incredible anxiety about money which seems to attack all widows. I have a theory, it's a sort of transposition. They're not allowed to say, I don't feel I can cope with life without him, but it's legitimate to say, I'm so worried about money. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there was a frantic selling off of such few valuable bits of furniture and bric-a-brac as we possessed. And then after that, she started writing frantically. But it got more and more frantic as she began to get more and more ill. I have another theory about that, which is that we, 90% of us have cancer somewhere. It is not necessarily in a fatal place, but even if it is, our mental condition determines how fast it progresses.
I've often thought that too.
And when he died, you know, the fighting spirit was gone, and so the cancer galloped away.
I'm sure that I've observed that in one or two relatives of mine. There's some emotional thing in their lives, and they get cancer after that. I'm sure there must be something in this, a sort of trigger mechanism.
Yes.
So a lot of that urgency, you see, I hadn't quite realised what the motive was, that part of it was she just knew she wouldn't be there for long. That does put a slightly different picture on it. But she did write awfully well, you know, I think. I mean, if only she could have written that autobiography and finished it, it would have been very good, I think. I've often quoted it and used it in other contexts, you know, I mean, because it's so vivid, especially the picture of Blackburn and, you know, what life was like. It's very, very well done, actually.
And I think if she could have concentrated on writing after the Women's Freedom League collapsed, instead of all these tuppenny halfpenny little things she got involved with.
Do you think, there's a puzzle which puzzled me actually while I was writing this a lot, do you think the curiously episodic character of her middle career, that is, she suddenly appears on the scene and then vanishes again, sort of swoops down almost and then is off.
Yes.
Is that related, do you think, to her illness that you mentioned, or is it just that she is impatient with people who won't move as fast as she does and goes off again? I mean, I wondered if there was a sort of purely medical reason for this. Did her skin condition get better and then come back again?
It was bad for about 30 years,
really?
25 years, and then it suddenly vanished when she was in her 70s, which I believe some of these skin conditions do.
Really?
I think it was more what you said first, that she got impatient with their failure to move at her pace or in her way. And sometimes I think she was pushed out. She had a sort of innocence. She believed the best of everybody until it was absolutely proved that that was not the case. I can remember two individuals in particular in two separate societies that both father and I kept saying to her, don't listen to her, she's a troublemaker, she's saying this about you to somebody else and she's saying what she's saying to you about that person, deliberately to stir up trouble between you. But you couldn't believe that anybody could be so mean and horrible as to do that. And another one in another organisation, and we said, for goodness sake, don't lend her any money. She's never going to pay you back. She's telling hard luck stories all over the place. She wouldn't believe that either. And I think once she found out, you know, she was probably so violently rude to them that this kind of person can always gather a gang together. She very often got pushed out of things as well as losing interest.
Yes.
And then once that happened, once the seborrheic dermatitis had started, then her depression at her appearance would be enough to make her not go.
Right.
Turn away.
Well, this is perhaps too crude, but was there a relationship between her dermatitis and her setbacks, do you think, at all?
There could have been, because it did fluctuate.
Mm. But you didn't particularly
notice
it?
But I didn't notice it particularly.
No.
When I have dermatitis too, of a less objectionable sort, and only on my hands and none at the moment. And it fluctuates, but I can't relate it to anything in particular.
Mm. It's a terrible thing, actually. My mother had it as well. Can be awful things. Yes, that does clarify quite a lot, actually. But when she has one of these setbacks, presumably by the time you're around to talk to, she's beginning to see a pattern in her life, isn't she? I mean, the pattern that you described to me when we talked before, of continual splits and rounds. I mean, did she become self-conscious about that, do you think?
No, I don't think she did. And I don't think, I mean, she may have seen it whenever each split occurred or each group collapsed, but I don't think she saw it continuously. I don't think when she got enthusiastic about something else, she thought, now hold on, is the same thing going to happen here? Father and I thought that, but
really,
we didn't
you
say
that.
It.
You did think that, didn't
we
you?
Did think that, yes, but we didn't say it to her.
Why not, actually, if I could ask you? I mean,
well,
I
didn't, because I thought it would hurt her, and I expect that was his reason too.
But you saw it. That's
we saw it, and we sometimes looked at each other. We didn't need to say both something. He might have said, aren't you going to finish so-and-so, because she had various attempts at writing murder stories and things like that. Partly to make money, I suppose. And partly because they were popular and she thought she could write a murder story whereas she couldn't write a serious novel. But she never finished any of them.
Why not, really? Because a cause came along to distract her, do you think? Because, I mean, what I'm asking that for, really, is why she didn't finish her memoirs, really? I mean, was it simply characteristic of her writing that she never finished anything? Or was it just that she was pushed for time for obvious reasons on the memoirs thing? Well, why did she drop these things?
I don't know. I think partly she got dissatisfied with them as she got dissatisfied with the organisations and the groups. They weren't good enough. And she couldn't tackle starting at the beginning again. The memoirs, I think it was just that her illness caught up with her.
Quite, yes.
Because the last 6 months or so were real hell.
Was it really? Yes. Yes. So, your father comes rather more centrally into the picture, really, than I'd imagined. Incidentally, the one point that I did, where I said that she was, I can't remember what I said, but I said she was unscrupulous.
Oh, yes.
What I think, what explains that is this, that she is so scrupulous that her behaviour is inexplicable to people who don't interpret it badly in certain circumstances. Do you see the paradox of the whole situation? I mean, sometimes people behave so rationally and so well that people must think there's some other motive. And so what I think, what I would want to say on that would be, not that she was unscrupulous, if that's what I said, but that she sometimes appeared to be so. Mm.
No, you didn't say it. Somebody said it. You quote somebody as saying.
Oh, yes. Mm. I can't quite remember now. But anyway, I think that must be the context of it. I think that must have been in relation to the moon at Westminster, actually, after the Second World War.
Yes.
But anyway, I think I can see how she might appear to be unscrupulous, while in fact being quite the reverse.
Mm.
Though in fact I haven't seen that said by anybody else. And of course the main thing about her is this sort of massive integrity, really, isn't it? I mean, it's an exaggerated integrity. Where does she get this perfectionism in her expectations of human beings from, then, do you think? I mean, you think that would have been put right rather early on.
It would indeed, yes.
I mean, of course, the Catholic religion really knocks that on the head. And we're perfectible, perhaps. Mm. We're certainly not perfect. Is there anything else about your father you think I ought to be aware of from the point of view of getting this properly balanced, and his contribution to agree? Did they talk much about the women's organisations, or was that a sort of subject where they... Well, your father was interested, wasn't he?
Oh, yes, he was. There was a cartoon of him when they married. It's I don't know whether you saw it. I think it's in the Fawcett Library. I'm not sure. It was in the Mirror. She was known at that time as the woman with the dog whip, because she spoke swinging her whip to keep the police away till she'd finished saying what she wanted to say. And so there was a cartoon of him and her in the background with her dog whip, and it was headed "The Bravest Man in the World." Oh, by the way, that reminds me, there's no reference to her three imprisonments. I think she would like to have had that.
No, I've got actually the dates of them now. I found them in the Public Record Office the other day. I'll certainly put those in, but I'll make a note to do that. No, certainly, they should be in. And when you say she'd be pleased to be remembered now, does that relate to a feeling that she was not being appreciated?
Oh, yes, I think so. And a feeling that she had wasted her life.
Really?
Yes. Oh, at times she had feelings of bitterness, and at times she said she should never have married and she should never have had a child and she should, you know, devoted herself to her work. Which was a very hurtful thing to say to your child who didn't ask to be born anyway, you know.
Quite, yes.
Once or twice she took herself off for several weeks to be alone and write, but nothing came out of it worth the fuss.
Mm. And the career she would have liked to have had would be still as a feminist, a writer,
yes,
or a leader.
Yes.
But not distracted by you or your father.
That's right.
On the other hand, she depends on you.
But she does, yes, she did.
Did she?
I don't think, you see, she couldn't have been a politician. She couldn't have stood it.
No. The sort of half light, the half decisions, the half truths. Yes. No, she was well out of that, I quite agree.
It's a sort of non sequitur, and it doesn't fit, does it? I mean, you work terribly hard to get more women in Westminster, but the sort of women who could succeed in Westminster are not the sort of women you would ever approve of.
Well, Lady Astor, of course, is a good example in some ways of that.
But she approved of Margaret Bonfield.
Did she? Yes.
And Eleanor Rathbone.
Yes. Yes, I wanted to ask you about both of those. Do you remember any sort of close relationship with either of them? I mean, did she sort of see much of them or talk about them much? She seems to be, to some extent, on her own in relation to them, as far as I can tell. But what about yourself, actually? I mean, did she confide in you as well, or did she want you to sort of join in, or even carry on from her and be a continuation of her?
No. I don't know whether she had hoped for that when I was very young, but by the time I was in my teens, no, she didn't expect that. She talked to me about it, yes. I thought that she put undue stress on some things, like the his-her business, and in the language. Come around much more to her view now. But at that time I was much more concerned about the way the language sounded, and to keep on having his-hers or invent new horrible words that were sexless offended my literate tastes. No, I don't think she ever really expected me to follow her.
She subsequently introduced you to these movements and so on.
Yes. I used to get dragged to the women's
Freedom League
as get togethers every year.
That must have been a bit grim for a young girl.
That was dreadful. Almost every second person I met said, "What is it like to have such a wonderful mother?" Mm. There's no answer to that, is there? You've never had any other kind of mother. How do you know?
Quite. Very difficult altogether. Mind you, there's some rather queer fish in the Women's Freedom League by the 30s, really. I mean, Miss Reeves was a bit odd, and so was Anna Munro, actually. And quite a lot of them, actually, were a bit strange. It was a bit of a cranky sort of thing by the 30s, I think.
Anna was an ethnic dresser long before the phrase was invented. I knew Anna quite well. Miss Reeves I never liked. I always thought she was a... But Mrs. Despard, I liked her very much.
Yeah, she had a little dignity about her, didn't she? And a sort of, maybe a slightly futile idealism, but nonetheless there was an idealism there, certainly.
And there was Muriel Perotti.
Yes.
And somebody else with curly hair. What was her name?
Well, it might have been Mrs. Howe Martin.
Oh, she was my Aunt Phyllis.
Really?
Yeah, she wasn't really, but she I mean, you were her aunt, that,
yes. Really, yes. Yeah. She's a rather attractive figure, actually.
Oh, very, yes. Yeah, she was a dear. And I mean, so was her husband, Herbert. They were my honorary aunt and uncle.
Really?
When father lost his job at B&W, so we had to sell the house in Northwood and come back to London. We lived for a year in their house in Hampstead Garden Suburb, because they just decided to go out to Australia and see if they liked it and end their life there if they did. And I'm sure we lived there rent free, just paying the electricity and rates and things.
Yes, she did have a brief Australian phase, that's quite true. So really your mother kept up socially with some of these Women's Freedom League women, even to the extent of your being required to call them aunt and
uncle. Oh, yes. I was quite happy to call those two aunt and uncle.
Yes, yes.
Yes, and there was somebody down in... there was someone called Gawthorpe that I never met, but there was someone...
Oh, Mary Gawthorpe, yes.
Yes, down in... was it Dorset or Somerset that we used to visit occasionally, that Mother was very fond of?
I think... not Isabel Seymour.
No.
I don't know who that would be. Anyway, that's interesting. What sort of friends did she have, really? I mean, were they mainly sort of feminist friends? Because she had a lot of Labour friends, didn't she, in the Glasgow phase?
Yes.
But did she have friends who weren't connected with her movements, really, of her own?
Latterly, I was very depressed that neither of them seemed to have any friends.
Mm.
No, I can't think of any. And of course the Labour ones died off.
Right.
Father had some for mostly Labour ones for a time, for quite a long time, but towards the end of their lives there were only the Rotarians that he was fond of, one or two of whom were also fond of Mother, but mostly not.
So really they were a bit driven on in on each other and on their own family life. Yes. But then you had this sort of, I don't know whether it was once or more than once, when you drove them around.
Yes. Every time we went to Scotland, which we tended to do every second year, we had to go through Derbyshire.
Really? Mm. And that was where they had their holidays and courtship?
Mm, where they met, and yes.
Does the myth actually still exist?
No, I went to look for it about 10 years ago and I couldn't even find the road. There's a new housing estate there now.
Really? So the whole house is gone?
Then I should think the whole area's been built over a lot further.
Really? The house was extremely cold, wasn't it?
Oh, it was dreadful. It was built on the Italian villa plan. Neither of them ever been to Italy. I suppose it must have been sort of Roman pictures they had. It was, it had a great long frontage facing northwest, I suppose.
Hawks, yes.
Because that was where the view was, you see. You could see Ben Lomond on a good day. And the mountains before you got to Ben Lomond on a bad day. It was northwest, and there was a huge living room with window, great big window with a window seat in it, and then a little window further down, and a window at that end which must have been facing, that would have been west.
Mm-hmm.
And then another window down here. This was a sort of, it was like an E without the central bar. And then there was the front door, and then there was the study, and then there was the kitchen, and the bathroom, one bedroom. And then my bedroom, which faced east, and their bedroom, which window faced south, that would be. They were lucky. And then there was a courtyard. All these rooms were linked by a passage which ran from the bedrooms down to the living room, with windows all along one side and a sort of courtyard.
And the windows
you were supposed to sit out in the nice summer day.
And these windows were facing north.
No, in every room except my bedroom and their bedroom had a north facing window. Of course, they all had vast expanses of outer wall with windows in.
Yes.
It was bitterly.
And it was your mother's design, wasn't it?
I think so, yes.
House. What about Northwood? Did they just buy a house at Northwood?
Yes, that was just a...
I know Northwood sort of reasonably well because I went to Merchant Taylor's School, so I know the area a bit.
Well, it was at the top of Sandy Lane.
Oh, really?
This
is quite near Merchant Taylor's, isn't it?
And now I think it's Pinner Hill has climbed up the hill. But at that point, the houses weren't necessarily very big, but they had about an acre and a half of grounds around them all, so that you couldn't actually see your neighbour.
Mm.
If you'd had to run for help to your neighbour, it wasn't all that far, but you couldn't see them.
And so your father was doing rather well.
It was a mile and a half to the station, and we didn't have a car, and I was still going to school.
Yes, no fun.
They gave me a first class season ticket because they thought this was a bit hard. It was my matric year, actually, that we moved out there.
Where did you go to school, actually?
North London Collegiate.
Oh, really, did you? Yes.
And I used to have great fun. There was no fun to be had going in the morning because the staff at the station knew me and knew that I had a first class ticket, and the businessmen that I sat with after their first initial dislike of this schoolgirl soon got used to me. But coming back in the evening, I used to have great fun. I used to get into an empty first class carriage at Baker Street and put my feet on the seat opposite and tip my hat back and chew something and wait for a porter to come and challenge me.
But anyway, they had to move from there to Wimbledon. Well, they had to move from there to the Howe Martins.
There to Howe Martins, and then we went to Corringham Road in Golders Green.
Really?
And things were getting worse and worse financially at that point, so we let that and moved into a horrible little flat in Netherhall Gardens. Do you remember Netherhall Gardens?
No, where is it? It's vaguely in
It's off Finchley Road, just about opposite Finchley Road Station.
Oh, I see.
Terribly steep hill, some houses at the top.
Mm.
And we stayed there until the Blitz. And during the Blitz, the Germans were particularly keen on getting those two railways, and they bombed them almost every night. And the whole of the house shook as if you were in an earthquake. And every morning when you went out and looked at the garden, the cracks in the garden were getting wider and wider.
Mm.
So we decided it would be as well to move. So we went over to Belsize Park to a semi-basement flat.
And then from there to Wimbledon?
And from there to Wimbledon, when I decided to take a hand in the situation.
Mm.
Because this flat in Belsize Park was rented. And I think it was a 5-year lease at first, and then they made it 3 years. And then after that it was annually, and they put the rent up each year.
Mm.
I didn't think there was much future in that.
Of course, that's one root of your mother's increasing distance from the labour movement, isn't it, towards the end of her life, that inflation is pushing up and up and up, and she's being hit by it, isn't she, rather badly. And, you know, she always had been critical of trade unions, but, you know, it rather came uppermost at that point for that reason, didn't it?
I don't remember it being connected with inflation, but maybe it was.
I've noticed her mention it once or twice in her letters later life. But you think there were other reasons as well, do you?
I think it was the injustice to the consumer, you see.
Mm.
I mean, the fact that the trade unions were being as disregardful of the consumer's interest as the employer's.
Mm. Mm. That appears in her book of 1912.
Yes.
Which is a good book, actually, I think, anyway. Though, again, tactless in the sense that it's going to antagonise the labour movement and it's going to antagonise the existing consumers' organisations, of whom she's very critical.
Mm.
So who is there left to latch on to?
That's totally unimportant. Truth is what matters.
Yes, well, quite. Yes. Yes. Anything else? I think you should be free to say how you would modify this and rewrite it to make it more accurate as a picture of your mother. I don't want it to be misleading. And I certainly put a lot more in about your father to make the context better. I think it is necessary. What other things do you think I've got wrong, actually, in this?
I don't think it's got wrong so much as something missing. I mean, I've naturally been talking during these last few weeks to the friends I've happened to meet who knew her.
Oh, splendid.
And they have all said the same thing when I said, what do you remember most about Mother? They all said her warmth and her kindness.
Really?
And how she always wanted you to feel at home. And
really? Tell me more about this, because I hadn't really... You see, I wouldn't have realised that was so.
No, well, it did a little surprise me, because I always felt that my friends found her a little intimidating. But that's not what they remember. They remember warmth and kindness and going to a lot of trouble for them. One of them said, of course, when she started to talk politics, it was way over my head, and I felt, my goodness, life must have been difficult for Fiona sometimes. But, and of course, when I think back, I wished to have wonderful children's parties. Father was never around then, of course. They were always in the afternoon, so she must have been good at that. I can remember large numbers of children sitting around eating tea and prattling away to her.
Was she good with children?
Yes, in a sort of kind teacher way.
Mm. Not sort of thinking as they think in the way your father did, sort of thing.
No,
not
no.
Really.
Very
few people have got that.
But being kind and listening to them seriously and putting them right when they were going wrong.
Right.
But,
yes. So that's, would it also extend to hospitality, for instance? Was she good at entertaining people? Did she like having people to stay? Mm. That sort of thing.
Yes, she was.
Mm. Yes, you see. I hadn't quite realised. What about sort of heat and food and that sort of thing? I mean, would people, when they stayed, be warm enough?
Oh, yes. Warm enough and certainly well-fed.
Really?
Mm. Mm. And comfortable. I think that's... racial? Geographical? Scots and Lancashire are both hospitable.
Oh, very much so, yes.
Places where comfort is important. I remember myself... The first time I went to tea with a school friend down here, after we came down here, being quite appalled at that house. And I don't remember actually saying this, but I've told that I came home and said to my mother in horror, we had fish paste sandwiches and bought cakes. Later I remember, because I stayed with that friend several times, they did over their drawing room every second year, completely. Carpets, drapes, as she liked to call them, furniture covers, decorating scheme, everything. And they did over the hall and their dining room about every fifth year, and their bedroom. The children's bedrooms and the kitchen were practically never done, and the children's beds were all lumpy and horrible.
Mm.
This kind of standard
was
absolutely alien to me and to both my parents, but I think that's, as I say, more their upbringing than their personality.
Yes, that would certainly fit. I mean, North Lancashire hospitality is well known.
Mm.
And Lancashire warmth, actually, too.
Yes.
One does have a feeling of friendliness when one gets north of the Trent, really, I think, more than south, actually. Yes, that's very helpful, because I hadn't really quite appreciated that. And she would actually put herself out to make the cakes and do the meal and everything.
Mm. Mm.
What about food, actually? What was she interested in food? What sort of things?
She was erratic. She was a good cook at the things that she liked to cook, but sometimes she wouldn't really be bothered. She made marvellous scones and waffle cakes we used to have for breakfast sometimes. And she made good cakes. They tended to collapse in the middle because there was too much fruit in them, but they tasted marvellous. But she hadn't got... And good plain cooking sort of thing, roasts and hot pots and things. She hadn't any patience for fancy cooking. But once I got interested in cooking, we managed quite amiably in the kitchen together. I would do one course and she would do the other, and it worked quite well.
And your father doing the cooking at weekends?
Yes.
Or Sunday?
His repertoire was limited, but what he did all right, except he liked to leave too much fat in the fry-ups. Now, one thing I remembered while I've been thinking about her was during the war, she had the idea of running an at-home for the RAF cadets down the road in St John's Wood. She went to see one of the officers there, I think it was the padre who was in charge of that aspect of things, and he said, yes, splendid idea, we'd like it very much. I was very dubious about how this would work. And I think I suggested that we should ask some of the nurses, because Charing Cross had a nurses' hostel at the end of our road, if they would like to come to liven it up a bit. And it was a great success. We used to have two or three young men every Thursday and two or three nurses. Of course, the food we could give them was very limited because it was right in the middle of the war and rationing. And my parents were very successful with them. I mean,
really?
Mother was sort of quiet and welcoming initially, but once, if they were the sort that weren't prattling much themselves, she would talk quite a lot about her childhood, and they seemed to find that very interesting. We had to restrain father from seeing the nurses home because he felt that young girls should be escorted home by the host, and he had to say, the boys want to take them home. obviously they like just coming and sitting in a home and talking ordinary.
I'm sure talk. It does make a difference, actually. I remember my National Service, that was... What about the war, actually? She taught for a bit, didn't she, in the war?
Yes, she taught at King Alfred's for a bit.
Yes. What else did she do, really?
Well, she did quite a bit for the LCC. Did I say something about that? But she took various parties out.
Wait a minute.
Evacuation parties.
I think you did say something, didn't it? Yes, you did. In the beginning of the Second World War, she also involved herself in voluntary work for the LCC. You're quite right, yes. Yes. Looking after evacuees and so on, yes.
Before we left Nohall Gardens, she did something very characteristic. There was an empty house next to us which belonged to Walter Reynolds, I think his name was. He wrote a play about patriotic young England, which was a great success to be laughed at. Don't remember what it was called, something like George for England or England for St. George.